It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Another suspected Islamist militant attack in Nigeria. The death toll rises in clashes between suspected tribal gunmen and Ugandan forces. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Suspected Islamist militants disguised in army uniforms reportedly killed 7 people in an attack near the northeast border with Cameroon in Borno State. The French press agency says a police station and military camp were destroyed during the late Sunday attack in the village of Krenua. Police authorities say some 5 of the militant insurgents were killed. AFP also reports the Nigerian police Monday uncovered a plot to bomb a secondary school in the city of Gombe. A spokesman said police defused a car laden with explosives. The government Monday said it was moving closer to finding more than 200 schoolgirls abducted from Chibok in Borno State in mid-April. Michael Mary is a Nigerian government spokesman.
They are moving closer to finding them. At least we have identified a number of leads we have identified in the course of this exercise, and that was what even led to the arrest of, the chief of intelligence of Boko Haram, and also some of the female recruiters and manners of Amori and so forth and so on.
Sources in northern Nigeria also say more than 60 women and girls kidnapped by the militant group Boko Haram 2 weeks ago have escaped. Nearly 70 people were killed during Saturday's attack in western Uganda after gunmen clashed with security forces in several towns near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. As Hillary Hill reports, authorities blame tribal militia.
They targeted police and military installations, as well as private homes. By Monday, the death toll from the attacks had risen to 68, according to Army spokesman Paddy Nkunda. 10 civilians were killed, he said, along with nearly 50 of the assailants themselves. Nkunda said the attackers were tribal militiamen and that they were repulsed when they attacked the Ugandan Army, or UPDF.
They attacked police. They stole guns. They took away 13 guns. And when they attempted to attack UPDF dealt with them. They are still investigating to find out the motive behind these attacks.
No group has claimed responsibility, but experts have speculated that the violence could be linked to land rights disputes in the area, which is home to Uganda's newly discovered oil. The region also borders the Democratic Republic of Congo, where armed groups have spent decades fighting for control of natural resources. 40 of the suspected attackers have been captured, and authorities are investigating to find out who is responsible. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
Kampala Monday said international donors who are withholding aid have misinterpreted the country's new anti-homosexual law, which imposes prison terms of up to life for aggravated homosexuality. The government statement said no activities of individuals, groups, companies, or organizations are being affected by the law. It says the new law enacted in February is aimed at curbing the open promotion of homosexuality. Reuters reports many civilians killed as rebel fighters and armed Muslim civilians attacked a church compound in Bambari in Central African Republic. Church officials say members of the Salika rebels and civilian members of the town's Muslim community entered St. Joseph's Cathedral in mid-afternoon. A Salika spokesman said the attack was in retaliation for an earlier anti-Balaka attack on Muslims. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi warned Monday Islamist militants are ravaging the Middle East and pose a threat to everyone's security. He says there are sister states being destroyed and split up in the name of religion. Could this happen in Egypt, he asks. I swear this will never happen in Egypt. In his televised remarks, the Egyptian leader also defended his cuts in fuel and electrical subsidies as part of the bitter pill required to bring the country's budget deficit under control. A U.S. citizen in Ghana is being tested for Ebola, which has killed nearly 500 people across West Africa this year. Ghana's health ministry said a patient was quarantined at the Niaho Clinic in the capital Accra while tests are underway at a local medical institute. The first semifinal match at football's World Cup is set for later today between host Brazil and Germany. The Germans are widely favored to win because Brazil will have to play without star striker Neymar, out with a fractured vertebra, and captain Thiago Silva, who accumulated 2 yellow cards, resulting in an automatic 1-game suspension. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyans rally for political change and dialogue.
Most important issue, first and foremost, is security. There is insecurity in this country. There is what we call tribalism. We want to eradicate totally. And thirdly, the most important is unemployment.
Moses Onyango is one of the thousands who rallied yesterday in Nairobi. Striking South African workers say they are close but yet far apart on reaching a deal. Three witnesses who testified before the ICC have been returned to their country. And former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai calls for a national dialogue.
It's a year since the last election, and things are appearing to be going down. The poverty is increasing, unemployment is increasing, and they are wondering, what is the solution?
Nigeria's Election Commission promises improved measures for next year's elections, and a young activist trumpets the benefits of girls' education. Those stories plus Mark Omar Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's opposition parties called for a national dialogue with the ruling administration and issued a list of key demands at a rally Monday in the capital, Nairobi. As VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports, the event turned violent momentarily as police fired tear gas to quell rowdy protesters.
Thousands came out to Nairobi's Uhuru Park for the so-called Saba Saba Day rally, organized by supporters of former Prime Minister and opposition mainstay Raila Odinga, who lost to President Uhuru Kenyatta in a disputed election last year. A heavy deployment of security forces from the Army, Police, and National Youth Service kept watch over the events. Speaking to the crowd in Swahili, Odinga called for the ruling Jubilee administration to sit down for talks to work through some of the many challenges facing the nation. Where there is a will, there is a way, Odinga said, and what we want today is a national dialogue. Members of the opposition CORD coalition read a list of demands for the government, including immediate steps to withdraw Kenyan troops from Somalia, where they are battling al-Shabaab militants as part of an African Union peacekeeping mission. Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for recent attacks in eastern Kenya, including coordinated assaults on a police station and trading center Saturday that left at least 21 people dead. The group has said it will continue to target Kenya as long as the country's troops remain in Somalia. Moses Onyango came to the rally from North Mathare neighborhood of Nairobi. He says the opposition feels sidelined by the current government.
Most important issue, first and foremost, is security. There is insecurity in this country. There is what we call tribalism. We want to eradicate totally. And thirdly, the most important is unemployment. Yeah.
An opposition resolution read at the rally expressed concern about the victimization of certain ethnic groups in Kenya and called for an audit to examine appointments made in the public sector to reveal names and ethnic backgrounds. Tribal tension in the country exploded following the disputed 2007 presidential election, sparking inter-ethnic fighting that left more than 1,100 people dead across the country. Many Kenyans stayed home Monday out of fear the Saba Saba Day rally could raise tensions. Some small skirmishes between security forces and protesters erupted before and after the rally. Police used tear gas and fired rounds into the air to disperse rowdy youths who ran through the nearly deserted streets of downtown Nairobi following the event. The Jubilee administration has rejected the call for dialogue with the opposition. Last week, Deputy President William Ruto accused CORD of seeking to divide the country. Other Jubilee members say the opposition should express their grievances in Parliament. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
An official of the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, known as NUMSA, says they are close but yet far apart from a deal to end South Africa's latest strike, which marks its first full week today, Tuesday. This comes after South Africa's Labour Minister Mildred Oleifant reportedly said Monday that a wage deal was closed, but Steve Nkapo, head of the Union Department for Organizing Collective Bargaining and Campaign, says while the employer's offer of a 10% increase might satisfy the union's demand of a double-digit wage increase, it only covers about 10% of workers. He tells me the union would like for any deal to cover at least majority of workers.
We are a bit closer to a deal, but we're also far. As I said, the problem that we're sitting with the current offer on the table is that it might be closer to a double digit as required by our members, but the problem is that it's double digit for fewer workers. So we're trying to make sure that majority of workers benefit from the double digit increase over a period of 3 years. That's one issue on the salaries and percentage that we might be closer. But however, on the issues that of job security, issues of short time, and issues of labor brokers, which we want them to be banned, we're still a bit far. We want a wording that will make sure that labor brokers are not misused in the industry. They can be used properly if they are needed.
So a 10% wage deal would be okay, except that you want to know what percentage of the workers will be covered.
That's exactly what we're saying. If the employer can come with a 10% or more, but for majority of workers in the industry, currently they are putting 10% for a grade that only covers 20% of the total workforce. Now, that is not going to assist us. If that 10% or more you cover about 50 to 60% of the workforce, which are mostly the lowest paid workers, and then we will then think that we are much closer to the deal.
You have been on strike now for a week. How are your members doing financially?
The biggest problem we have is that our members have sacrificed their life for this better pay. So that's why we say we don't take a strike as a light thing. It's the biggest problem that our members are not going to be paid. However, they think it's a sacrifice that they deserve to do, because for long-term benefit, then it will assist you. For example, if you get 10% of the increase, then all your other benefits like your provident fund, your pension fund, and all those things does increase substantially. That's why it's a sacrifice they think they deserve. However, as I'm saying, before we go on strike, there's a serious discussion that are taking place because of the same issues that our members are not going to be paid.
Steve Nkapo is the head of the Union Department for Organizing Collective Bargaining and Campaigns. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg. In Zimbabwe, Movement for Democratic Change leader Morgan Tsvangirai has called for a national dialogue. Tsvangirai tells reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program that the country is on the wrong path 1 year since the last presidential election.
The general feeling of despondence is arising out of the fact that it's a year since the last election and things are appearing to be going down. The poverty is increasing, unemployment is increasing, and they're wondering what is the solution. And sometimes you listen to those kind of comments and you feel the national responsibility of the national crisis. So one of the suggestions that's emerging from the people is that there needs to be dialogue. And I think there is an emerging consensus on the need of people to sit down as Zimbabweans to resolve this issue.
This national dialogue that you are referring to, is this the second coming of the Mugabe Tsvangirai GNU?
No. I think let me give it to you that, first of all, in the face of a national crisis, the people in that country must sit down and find a solution. In this case, it's no longer something that is initiated by outsiders. Is something that is necessary for Zimbabwe, for the solution of the Zimbabwean crisis. So that's the first objective. The second objective is to learn lessons from the first negotiated GPA. The lesson fundamentally is that we put in a government over a wrong structure. Instead of dealing with ZANU-PF hegemony, to dismantle ZANU-PF hegemony and its institution and set a new system, we just put a government which failed to produce the necessary reforms because ZANU-PF remained adamant on the question of reforms. Lastly, I think what is important is that this time around, it's not just the political elites that should sit down and talk over what needs to be done. I think we need to expand the stakeholders. And one of the things that is there is that we don't need outsiders. I think we've worked together for the last 4.5 years. Why can't we sit down, agree on a platform and agenda that will resolve the crisis that we face as a country.
But some hardliners in ZANU-PF have clearly stated that they are not keen on dialogue.
Well, what solution do they have except to retain power? And that's the danger of those that will define themselves as hardliners. Hardliners to maintain power without legitimacy is not going to solve the problem of this country.
You say in your statement Mr. Mugabe is marooned from reality. Do you think he is not aware that Rome is on fire?
If he is aware of what's taking place, has he ever responded to it, or he has actually added the fuel to fire? Has he ever done anything about it? No. Has he tried to give us some direction as to how he hopes to resolve the economic crisis? No. So we all face the consequences of President Mugabe's lack of political initiative and paralysis.
That was Zimbabwe opposition leader and former Prime Minister Marcus Tsvangirai speaking from Harare with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 5th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The spokesman for Nigeria's Independent Electoral Commission says the electoral body will implement improved measures to ensure the credibility of next year's presidential, legislative, and local elections is not compromised. Kayode Idowu tells reporter Peter Clarty that the commission is also working closely with the country's security agencies to prevent possible violent attacks by Boko Haram militants that could scare away prospective voters from participating in the elections.
The commission has started preparation for the election in 2015. And part of the things that we have done towards the elections is that we have commenced the distribution of the permanent voter cards that will be used in the elections for 2015. Because the commission will be using permanent voter cards contrary to 2011, when we use cold laminated cards that we call federal voter cards. This time we are going to be using smart cards with microchips containing the data of each voter. And we are commencing using that card in states of the federation. We have done it in about 40 states now. We have also acquired the machine, the electronic card readers that to be used for authenticating voters in 2015.
Specifically for next year's general election, there have been concerns that there could be what some people describe as electoral engineering, where some people will try to rig the vote for one party or another. This time around, what measures will the Electoral Commission implement to ensure that the credibility of the election is not in doubt?
Good question. You see, that is the whole point of the smart cards that I said we are deploying to be used. In the past, people abused the electoral process through the use of the cold laminated card that can be acquired and used by somebody else other than the person who legally owns the card. Now, with the smart cards that we are using, only the rightful owner of the card will be able to use that card. And what that means is that people can no longer abuse the process by acquiring cards and issuing cards to people who are not the legitimate owner of these cards to go and vote for them. That's the only thing that we are doing.
There are issues of increasing violence perpetrated by militants, including Boko Haram. How is the Electoral Commission working with security agencies to ensure that prospective voters in the general elections are not harmed or prevented by acts of violence or attacks by these militants?
The commission has been working with security agencies on the platform of what we call the Inter-Consultative Committee on Election Security, whereby security agencies come together to synergize and design operational orders specific to a particular state.
Kayode Idowu is the spokesman for Nigeria's Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clarty from the capital, Abuja. A human rights campaigner says any would-be witness of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, who feels that his or her life might be at risk should first seek guarantees that he or she would be protected before agreeing to testify before the court. Richard Dicker, director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, says witnesses who feel they might be at risk should first seek relocation to another country before testifying. This comes after the lawyer for three Congolese witnesses who testified before the ICC said his clients were returned to Kinshasa on Sunday after they failed to get asylum in the Netherlands. Dekker tells me Human Rights Watch had sent a letter last week appealing to the Dutch government not to send the three back to the DRC.
Essentially, we expressed real concerns that these three may not receive all the safeguards for fair trial back in DRC if they were returned there. We cited the European Convention on Human Rights and its principle of non-refoulement, which means that these individuals should be protected.
The ICC is saying that it agreed for these people to be sent back after receiving guarantees from the government of the DRC that these people will not face the death penalty. They themselves were imprisoned in the DRC.
Yes.
So do you think this is an arrangement that can work?
Well, we think the best way at this point was for the government of the Netherlands to hold off on sending them back until they were absolutely convinced that they were satisfied that the right of these three individuals to a fair trial would be protected.
I'm looking at other cases that are pending within the ICC. Take the case of the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, and his deputy president. Does this send a very chilling message to other would-be witnesses?
I think you're putting your finger on a very important point, James, in terms of the potential chilling effect the decision could have on other witnesses in different cases. Now, I think any witness who feels he or herself is at serious risk needs to raise that with the ICC at the outset and explore the possibility of witness relocation so that that danger you're suggesting would not be a factor.
Richard Dicker is the director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from New York City. A young activist for girls' education is calling on the United Nations to come up with a tangible plan of action to end the discrimination that keeps girls out of school. UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador in Ethiopia, Hannah Godefa, reflects on the passion that drives her to speak out for the right of all girls and women to be educated. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
To say that Hannah Godefa, who was born in Canada to Ethiopian parents, is a remarkable young woman does not do justice to her list of accomplishments.
Honestly, being a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador has been one of the greatest joys of my short 16 years of living.
She was appointed to the post in January 2013 at age 15. Since then, Godefa has been visiting Ethiopia and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa to promote the benefits of girls' education. She tells VOA it is her job to speak out on behalf of the millions of girls around the world who do not have access to schooling.
Girls also face a lot of responsibilities that I'd say discourage them from attending school, lots of family responsibilities. There are so many cultural barriers for girls to prevent them from receiving education, and many economic factors that families have to consider when they're choosing whether to send their boys to school or whether to send their girls to school. So all the odds are stacked against them, and that's why we have to target them and support them and protect them.
Godefa's involvement with children's education began at age 7. During a visit to relatives in rural Ethiopia, she made a good friend and wanted to keep in touch with her when she returned home. She was frustrated to learn her friend did not have pencils or paper. So she founded the Pencil Mountain Project, which she says has distributed more than 500,000 items for use in schools.
So things beyond pencils, like other basic school supplies, as well as textbooks for second-generation universities, some of the newer universities that have been constructed in Ethiopia, as well as wheelchairs for students with disabilities, and a whole bunch of supplies that are under the umbrella of basic education for students. And that's for boys and girls.
Godefa says she believes she's having an impact as Goodwill Ambassador. Coming from Canada, she says, makes her living proof of the benefits of sending a girl to school. On the other hand, she says having Ethiopian roots gives her insight into the country's traditional practices and helps her navigate around cultural mindsets that keep girls out of school. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Botswana's Africa champion Isaac Makwala set an Africa 400-meter record of 44.01 seconds at Le Chaux de Fonds, Switzerland, on Sunday. This shaves off 0.09 seconds from the 44.10 seconds effort by the Democratic Republic of Congo's Gary Kikaya in Stuttgart, Germany, in 2006. Makwala went on to triumph in 200 meters in 19.93 seconds, making him the second quickest ever after Namibia's Frankie Fredericks ran 19.68 seconds at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. Turning to football, Bosnian tactician Vahid Halid Hodzic has stepped down as coach of Algeria's Desert Fox, the highest-placed African team on the current FIFA rankings. His contract expired at the end of Algeria's World Cup campaign, where he steered them to their maiden appearance beyond the group phase of the competition for the first time in Algeria's four outings at the World Cup. Despite a personal request from Algerian head of state Abdelaziz Bouteflika to stay, Halid Hodzic opted to leave, citing family commitments. He showered the Algerian public with praise for their support during his three-year tenure and has forgiven sections of the Algerian mainstream media for their often harsh criticism of his work. Moving on to the World Cup in Brazil. Although eliminated by Netherlands on Saturday, Costa Rican goalkeeper Keylor Navas leaves Brazil with something to cheer after he notched his third Man of the Match award. He earned his latest accolade after the match against Netherlands. He earlier earned the award from matches against England and Greece. Navas and Argentine captain Lionel Messi have accumulated the most Man of the Match awards at the World Cup. Finally, hosts Brazil tackle Germany in the first semi-final in Belo Horizonte today, Tuesday. They will miss their top scorer, Neymar, who is now out of the tournament with an injury to his spinal cord. Brazil will also play without their captain, Thiago Silva, who has accumulated two yellow cards. Germany are semi-finalists for the third consecutive outing. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Tuesday morning comes from Mohammed Ahmed Masur of Monrovia, Liberia. He writes, "Dear VOA, I think refugees are human beings and should be treated as such. I call on the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to do everything possible to keep this promise." We thank you, Mohammed Ahmed Masur of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Tuesday, July 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa. But please stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, we'll talk about love therapy with our guest, Dr. Sue Johnson, clinical psychologist, author, and an expert in the field of couples therapy. Email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call in during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.